brace yourself.
Are you all right?
For a revelation.
Someone tried to kill you, Garrick.
More shocking.
Why would the Romulans want to have Garrick killed?
More catastrophic.
Sounds like they're preparing for an invasion.
More devastating than the Federation has ever confronted.
You'll be taking Romulus and Cardassia into war.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton. Try never to tell the same lie twice.
And succeeding mightily.
Yes.
Well, welcome for another two-part flashback, this time to another Cardassian torture two-parter.
They're among my favorites, Cam.
Yes.
Those Cardassians, they love to put it to you.
Today, we're going to talk about the DS9 two-parter from the third season, Improbable Cause and the Die is Cast. The first time ever that Trek had a two-parter that didn't have a part one and part two, which is really frustrating for me.
Trouble keeping them apart now or realizing that that is in fact a two-part episode?
I have to remember two titles.
Yeah.
That just gets a little, you know, my mind is already very cluttered and disorganized and it just confuses me right off the bat for an episode here.
Fair enough. Well, I don't think Improbable Cause Part 2 quite has the same ring to it, so.
If you were going to do Part 1 and Part 2, which title do you stick with? The Die is Cast?
No, you know, I would have come up with something entirely different.
Okay.
It would have been like Odo and Garrick's crazy adventure, something like that, you know.
Because I know the working title was Improbable Cause 1 and 2.
Oh, okay. Meh.
Eh.
Okay. Cam, you watched this episode for the first time, what, about 6 years ago?
Yeah, about that.
Do you remember it standing out as much? Because I think the reason why we want to kind of delve into this, and it's interesting as we go further into Deep Space Nine, is we're realizing that these two-part episodes that they're doing, they're not so much like these one-off adventures that you'd see in Next Generation or Star Trek Voyager, like with an episode like Time's Arrow or Basics 1 and 2.
The Killing Game.
The Killing Game, of course. But these are more kind of the mythology episodes, similar to what we would see in, say, The X-Files, you know, when they would focus on the aliens as opposed to the monsters of the week. So we're getting into a lot of the DS9 mythology, and I wonder how these work as two-part adventures versus just what we're used to when it comes to two-part episodes.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because that ran through my mind too. You know, you had in this episode, you know, Odo has like the informant he's meeting with, very much like Deep Throat from the X-Files, Deep Throat or X.
Right.
And, you know, the character's, you know, not really introduced and wanders off screen. You know, it's that sort of mythology where it's like fans are going to, you know, take something away from it. But if you're like a newbie, forget it. This episode is pretty much indecipherable.
Well, it's an episode focused on a recurring character,
yeah.
One, Garrick. This is the first time that I think, well, I take that back. We've gone deeper into Garrick before, but I think this is probably one of the deepest looks into Garrick, because I believe The Wire aired before this one as well, and I think that was probably the first Garrick-centric episode.
I didn't know he was on that HBO show.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, him, McNulty, Bubbles, he stood out a little bit, you know, but people don't do drugs.
Right.
Right. But the episode, yeah, that was, I remember Garrick was had all that control over, like, getting endorphins into his brain to resist torture, and that started malfunctioning. That was a great insight into Garrick, but this is diving really into the mythology that is Garrick that's been built up over the previous 3 years here.
Yeah, at the expense of almost the entire cast.
I'm okay with that.
No, you me know? Too, yeah.
Usually it bugs me if, you know, if an episode focuses on, like, the guest star of the week, you know, we see that in early Next Gen, see that a little bit in TOS, but that was kind of the format back in the 1960s. This, you know, Deep Space Nine, I'm down with it. You have other episodes like Treachery, Faith in the Great River, which is really like a Wei Yun showcase episode.
Right.
You know, DS9 can totally get away with this.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. And, you know, you were asking me, you know, I watched it 6 years ago.
Yes.
What my initial take was, I'm at a point in time now, as we kind of go forward into reviewing DS9 two-parters, where the titles mean nothing to me.
Okay.
I was at the point of binge-watching, and so, you know, the fact that there's not a part one and a part two to describe it, I'm like, oh, man, I can't remember anymore, because it's all, as you said, so deep into the mythology of the series.
Right.
However, watching this episode, I remember the first time through, what I really took away from this episode was the character of Tane, played by Paul Dooley, and his relationship with Garrick, his mentor figure, as well as the torturing of Odo. Those are the two things that really stuck with me a lot watching it the first time. And I remember being very uncomfortable watching it and, you know, seeing Odo be tortured. That's something that in Trek, traditionally, you might see Picard go through that in Chain of Command. But it's at the hands of, like, again, a sadistic monster, not a character we've been essentially indoctrinated to love.
Sure, yeah. I did like Odo going all Crypt Keeper on us, though. That was an interesting look.
See, I wrote Boris Karloff Mummy.
Oh, I see that there, of course. Okay. You know what? My first reaction back in the day, I do recall watching this first run back in the mid-90s. And this is actually, I think, the episode Second Skin featured Garrick. Didn't he vaporize somebody at the end of the episode?
This episode was actually supposed to be a real spinoff of that episode.
Okay.
And then they kind of rewrote it.
Second Skin, I that's when I really started getting into Odo, when I was watching it back in the 90s. And this was a great follow-up to that. The one thing that stuck out most to me is, and I alluded to it at the very beginning of the episode, but that conversation that he was having with Bashir when he was Bashir was telling him the story about the boy who cried wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I love how Garrick has a different interpretation of it. It's not that you keep lying and people won't believe you. It's you never tell the same lie twice. And that's always something that's stuck in my head about Garrick. And just what a fantastic character he is, how Andrew Robinson plays him. There's other stuff as we get into more of our discussion about the second part of the episode, The Die is Cast. There's stuff that I want to talk about his relationship with him and Tane as well, which I think is very interesting here. But look, this episode, at the time, how cool is it that you have the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar teaming up for, like, this operation, like the intelligence services of these respective empires teaming up and going after the Dominion? To me, that's fascinating. So,
and to tie it all together with an attempt on, you know, Garrick's life, drawing us right in with sort of that cloak and dagger stuff. And then teaming it up, him up with Odo for this sort of escapade. It's just a great way to take fan favorite characters and then tie them to a mythology story that could be really convoluted and actually comes across incredibly simple. Like, this does not feel like, you know, season 7 X-Files, where I'm watching a two-parter, like, feeling like I'm hallucinating on cough medicine.
You say it very simple, but, you know, you and I, we watched that George Smiley movie. Was it Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
Yeah.
You were not a fan of it.
I was not.
I loved it, but it had all these layers to it. Very kind of...
like an onion.
Very opaque storytelling, I'll fully admit, but I just dug it. But I think this is a very straightforward story. This actually reminded me, not necessarily storytelling-wise, but just in some of the direction we saw from Avery Brooks in part one, Improbable Cause. The Third Man. Have you ever seen The Third Man, Cam?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, just kind of the shadows being used reminded me very much of kind of Orson Welles being revealed.
The score was very similar with a zither.
Yes. But that's a great post-war kind of noir film, just talking about, I believe it took place in Vienna, like right after World War II.
Yeah.
Kind of Reconstruction sort of era. I love the parallels between, because I think that the Cardassians and the Nazis are supposed to have a lot in common. So.
Yes. I think, you know, we've talked in the past how, like, the Klingons are the Russians. The Cardassians are the Germans, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the Romulans in the equation then?
Well, I remember reading that they were intended, at least initially, to be like the Red Chinese.
Okay.
But I don't know that holds true going forward.
No. Not by the time we get to the 90s, really.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
At that point, they're just sort of more vague.
I'll say this, though. You can't really have an episode of Star Trek about espionage and all that sort of stuff without featuring the Romulans. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just pretty much wired into that sort of storytelling.
Oh, for sure.
Right. Why don't we tackle it this way? Why don't we start with our thoughts on Improbable Cause and how that performs as an episode, and then we can kind of follow the story and the progression here, because this is a different kind of two-parter. You spelled it out, though. It's not a part one, part two. And it's like we mentioned at the start here, it's more of a mythology episode, which is... We started to see that with The Search, parts one and two. In between, we had Past Tense, parts one and two. But now, I think DS9 is going full hog with mythology at this point.
Yeah, it's not even, you know, this is not even like a standalone story, really, with a big explosive ending that, you know, the end. It's, you know, it does have an ending, but it does feel like it's also leaving plenty of threads to continue the next episode and so on and so forth. But yes, Improbable Cause. Like this episode does a really good job, I thought, of just drawing you very, like, subtly into a story. Like, it's not a big explosive, although there is an explosion, I suppose.
On, but think before you speak.
You know, yes, Garrick's tailor shop is bombed. And, you know, that single event, though, really leads to an episode that's a lot quieter than I remembered.
Okay.
Of just Odo trying to investigate leads, trying to track down what could have caused this incident.
I like this showcase episode of Odo the Investigator.
I called it the Investigative Showcase.
Oh, did you?
In my notes here.
Okay. I dig that because I always love it when we see episodes, showcase episodes of characters where we see how competent they are and really good at their job. I love it when we see that on, say, Next Generation with, say, Troy, because she doesn't get that many opportunities to do that.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting. Think about Worf. Did we ever see a lot of Worf showcase episodes?
Sleuthing?
Where he's sleuthing, yeah.
There's a reason he was not Watson in the Inspector Data episodes.
Fair enough. I recall when he does come on Deep Space Nine, Odo pretty much tells him to shove off when he does attempt his own sleuthing there.
I could see Tuvok doing this.
Yeah. I think we have seen Tuvok episodes for... example, the first one featuring Lon Suter is played by Brad Dourif. I'm forgetting.
I think it's Meld, isn't it?
Is it? Okay, yeah. That makes sense. That's one example, of him kind of, well, it was a pretty easy case to crack because Suter says, yeah, I killed him. I just wanted to feel it. Yeah.
Tuvok is just that good.
His interrogation, it can rival Garrick's.
Yeah.
Odo the Sleuth, I love this sort of stuff going on here.
Yeah, and also because it's tying it around Garrick. You know, Garrick isn't sort of a vague mystery character, you know, like say a noir film where it's say like the Icy Blonde or the Shady Businessman, a character where you maybe don't have an emotional connection to them. This is a case where it's a character who's mysterious, but one that we really think is cool.
Yeah, and the concern can always be is if you dive too deep in a mysterious character and you get to the Chewy center, is it really all that interesting at this point?
Right.
And I think they left enough open with Garrick. I do like this. We can get into it a little bit more with the Dias cast, but we get more into his motivations, like what's driving this character, and I think that's very good. We also get that with Odo as well.
Yeah, and the two are paralleled very nicely.
And that parallel wasn't so obvious to me in part one. Because I think there was a mention where, you know, Garrick was comparing himself to Odo. Oh, we're not that different, are we? But and I was like, I don't know. What do you guys really have that in common? But, you know, by the time you get to part two, yes, absolutely there. So, Cam, overall, one of the things that I did keep coming back to is why are Odo and Sisko so invested in this investigation into Garrick's attempt on his life?
Well, you know, Sisko's like, I already lost a school. Now I've lost a tailor shop.
I can't be the commander who keeps letting things blow up on my promenade.
What other critical section of the promenade will go down next?
And next, it's going to be that Agrellian massage parlor that Quark said that he wanted to put up at the end of this episode.
The bead store.
There is the Gach restaurants on the promenade. Where do Jake and Nog get their jum-jum sticks? That could be next.
The candy shop.
Yeah. What else? Remember the episode Rivals, that rival casino?
Yes, with the really crappy looking
like light bulb thing.
Yeah, gambling device. Yeah, the Chris Sarandon, right?
Yeah. Cam, we need to do
the Chris Sarandon showcase.
Well, no, a spin-off episode of crappy promenade shops.
It'll be our most downloaded episode yet.
Yeah. But look, okay, so I'm just wondering, because look, if you have a character like Garrick who's being very resistant every part of this investigation, should Odo's resources be going elsewhere at this point? Like, I understand why we're doing it from our writing perspective. This is a character that we're interested in following. But, I mean, from a character motivation perspective, it's like Sisko's like, look, this is a very sketchy guy. An attempt was made on his life. I wish they had maybe emphasized more public safety concerns. Like, if he's not been killed yet, maybe another attempt will be made and that could injure other people. Maybe that could have been more explicit.
Sisko did cite that, though, after the explosion, where he did say, you know, innocent people could have been hurt.
But he never says, well, let's find out exactly what happened so we can right. make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yes.
So I had a little bit of issues with maybe some of the motivation factor here. But I don't know, some fun sequences when you do see that Flaxian assassin with this fragrances that can give people heart attacks if you mix them together.
That's a very subtle assassination attempt.
How exactly does that work? Like, do you have to go into somebody's quarters, hold your own, like, you know, your sleeve against your nostrils, and then, like, mix this potion?
Well, how does this work? Like, he doesn't have, like, a kiosk. Does he go door-to-door? Is it, like, a Tiffany's? What were they called? The, not Tiffany's.
Mary Kay.
Mary Kay, thank you. Is it, yeah. like, the Mary Kay person coming to your front door?
Yeah, he's got his own pink Cadillac. Yeah.
Does he just show up at, like, people's quarters? Like, hi, I'd like to, you know, show you some of my fragrances.
If you're on somebody's hit list, are you really opening up your doors to door-to-door salesmen?
Much less one selling fragrances?
Yeah. I don't know if this is the smartest tactic. Yeah,
okay, let's look at this and try and figure out what this Flaxian was thinking. Is it also because Odo runs a tailor shop which caters to fashion, so maybe he's trying to sell, like, cross...
Garrick owns the...
Sorry, Garrick, yeah. Garrick, and so... It could be like a cross-promotional thing. He wants to promote his fragrances in Garrick's tailor shop.
That's a good way in. But remember, Odo does figure out that an assassin doesn't generally change the way that he goes about assassinating people.
Right.
So he's using this technique on pretty much everyone. He's only hired for jobs that are targeting, say, tailors, seamstresses.
Fashionistas.
Yeah, perhaps cobblers. You know,
is this the most fascinating assassin in the Star Trek universe?
I think he has to be. No wonder the Romulans wanted him dead.
The aroma assassin.
Yes. Bringing a whole new meaning to the word aromatherapy.
We may have to cut this episode short so I can start on my latest fan fiction story.
Yes.
Mr. Mott is about to be in a new adventure.
Oh, yes. Can't wait for that barber to get his comeuppance.
Yeah.
Okay, this assassin's technique, maybe a fun sequence on the show. It's a little silly, though, I have to admit.
I mean, it is, but I do like that this episode is having fun with the idea of sort of this colorful underworld.
Sure.
Like, that's what makes a lot of film noir crime stories fun is, you know, these hitmen or whatever with these very odd and eccentric approaches to their jobs. Here's a guy that fits that bill perfectly.
Speaking of that, kind of having fun with this world, though, what did you make of Bashir offering to do a favor for Garrick while he was gone, and Garrick saying, yes, I've got a secret panel in my bulkhead, and if you reach in there, there's an isolinear rod. Bashir's like, yes, tell me more. Garrick, I need you to eat it if I don't return in 2 days. I just like him messing with Bashir this whole time. Like, Bashir's still in like his kind of childlike phase
right.
at this point.
He's not cynical.
He's still eating it all up, whatever Garrick has to say.
He's eating up those isolinear
yes,
rods.
Yes, exactly. We also got the introduction not only of Enerin Tain, but Mila. And it's interesting here because we definitely see kind of, however they're projecting this kind of triumvirate of Mila, Enerin Tain, and Garrick, I think it evolves and changes over the course of a few seasons on Deep Space Nine, where I think it's different relationships. I do like how, I'll flash forward a little bit into part two, but Andrew Robinson's playing this very asexually, you know, and Odo says it's a mentor-protege relationship.
Right.
I could totally buy the way that Andrew Robinson was playing it as if those characters were something more than just that. Like, there was some sort of romantic entanglement previously. The way that we see these characters go in the future, I think it's heavily implied, if not explicitly stated, that Enerin Tain is Garrick's father and Mila is the mother. I don't think it's ever explicitly stated, but I think that
right.
is the big implication, especially after, spoiler alert, Mila's death scene at the end of season 7.
Right.
So it's interesting we see these characters early on. And look, of course, I think maybe they're just supposed to be one-offs at this point. So I don't think the writers were necessarily thinking that far ahead, but yeah, it's still cool to kind of examine them.
I really enjoyed Tane and his relationship with Garak, and that obviously pays off much bigger in the second part. I was curious, though, to you, which dysfunctional mentor-protege relationship is more interesting and more fun to you? Tane and Garak, or Odo and Dr. Mira?
That's interesting because they have different dynamics, where Odo is more like the resentful child, you know, against rebelling against his embarrassing pops.
Right.
I have to give it up to Paul Dooley and Andrew Robinson for the back and forth between those two. I really do dig it. Maybe not as dynamic as what's going on with Mora and Odo, but I do like this relationship and how it evolves and changes over the course of a few seasons here. Because no matter, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler alert. The show's been over for about 20 years, but we do see the return of Tane. He had a very vague sort of departure in this two-parter here.
Yeah, he'd sort of gone mad in the heat of battle, and that was the last we saw of
him. Well, which relationship do you dig?
I think you have to go with the Garak Tane one.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, and it's so superficial, Cardassians are just really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm instantly kind of compelled by these Cardassian figures, whether it's, you know, David Warner's character in Chain of Command, or Tane, who played by Paul Dooley, who I found really fascinating in that he's a very different type of Cardassian we normally see. There's almost like a warmth to him. He has sort of that almost... It's almost like a weird jovial quality, but it's also kind of hard-edged.
But what about the relationship between Kira and Gamor, though? Because that is kind of that patriarchal sort of, or not patriarchal, but that sort of fatherly relationship that we see is kind of similar with Garak and Tane here as well. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, even that scene with Gul Madred in Chain of Command, where he's interacting with his daughter.
Yeah.
You see that the Cardassians, no matter what you think of them, they absolutely have that parental instinct within them.
Dukat definitely did.
Yeah. He was willing to shoot his daughter right in the head. Dear.
But no, I mean, I really found this character of Tane just fascinating. You know, Paul Dooley doesn't have a lot of screen time. You know, he hasn't had like the Andy Robinson length of screen time, you know, across the series to build this character. Yeah. But I found Tane really fascinating, and I'm so glad they ended up bringing him back because this episode really had me intrigued by him in a way that, you know, I look at some of the other Cardassian villains, and they feel like kind of one-off bad guys. I like the complexity of this guy where he's obviously, you know, ruthless and pretty violent and has some really unpleasant approaches to how to deal with prisoners. But he also seems to have a certain amount of loyalty and respect for those around him. Like, you can see that him and Garak, he holds Garak in high regard. He's not someone who's, like, cynical or manipulative of Garak to a, you know, to a really mean degree.
Yeah.
He's
shepherded him into this role that Garak has.
Right. Like, he feels like what you would hope a good mentor would be. It just so happens that their business is very dirty.
I think so much of it really depends on the chemistry between the two actors here. If they hired, you know, an actor that kind of fell flat, would we really be begging for more appearances from Enebrin Tane?
Right.
Not necessarily here. I think we're starting to segue into part two. Before we get to that, though, I do want to mention one of the things that I don't quite understand about Star Trek is often the legal system here.
Yeah, okay.
How on earth are O'Brien and Odo allowed to put a transponder on the Flaxine Assassin's ship? Like, who's giving them warrants to do this? Or are they just deciding arbitrarily we can put this on a private citizen's vehicle and then just track him? Is there enough reason to do this, Cam? Do you think a Bajoran judge is signing off on this?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I don't know. Like, are they just taking some shady tactics to get to the larger picture?
I what I'm getting at here is I don't think the law means all that much to, say, Starfleet or the Federation. And we see that in part two a little bit with, say, Admiral Todman. you know.
Right. Although we, you know, DS9 is in a situation where they can kind of do that sort of thing because, again, it is the Frontier show. It's sort of this.
Sure, yeah.
You know, the rules don't apply on Deep Space Nine the way they would in, you know, like Picard ship. You're not going to see the Enterprise A doing this. Enterprise D.
If this was the Next Generation, do you think the episode would have been centered on Picard debating whether or not to put a transponder and violating the privacy of a private citizen?
That would be a riveting episode.
Yeah.
Do you think he'd do it?
I think he'd ultimately say no.
Yeah.
This far, but no farther. Yeah. One last thing before we get to part two, Cam. Garak's age. I'm curious about this because he said that, you know, he describes Mila as being the housekeeper and confidant of Enebrin Tain for just over 30 years. If Mila is the mother of Garak and Enebrin Tain is the father, how old is Garak exactly then?
I think it's quite obvious that Andy Robinson is 20 in this show.
Okay. I don't know. I think the implication, though, is that Garak's maybe perhaps much younger than Andrew Robinson is, you know, which is interesting when you think about how much of a resume do you think he was able to build as a member of the Obsidian Order before he was exiled.
How old do you think Garak is?
I always just assumed he was probably 45, 50, but this episode, if you extrapolate the numbers and if you do want to figure that Garak's being honest here, I think the implication is Garak could have to be around 35.
Does this make his eventual relationship with Tara Ziyal less creepy?
A tiny bit less.
Yeah.
Although Tara Ziyal is still like 14, right? When we meet her, she is like 14.
Oh, you're right.
But I'm just going to try to rationalize it like aliens age at different rates.
Right, like the Cass Neelix thing.
Yeah. Or the Worf and half Romulan, half Klingon woman in Birthright.
Right, right.
Well, I say woman. I'm being very generous with that description.
Will Discovery tackle this topic one day in an episode maybe called Age of Consent?
Oh, gosh. That'll be in another Star Trek spinoff. Star Trek, Age of Consent.
There's the story that no writer wants. No. That is like at the bottom of the demand list for the writers.
Now, why are you pitching this as an episode then, Cam? All right. Well, okay, why don't we jump into part two here? Because it starts off with another scene at lunch, just as part one did. But this time, Bashir's really lamenting the fact that he has to have lunch with a barbarian such as O'Brien, who just wants to slurp his soup and get out of there.
O'Brien would annoy me, I gotta be honest.
If he's not engaging with you at lunchtime?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't really blame you for that.
Though. No.
Yeah. But look, at least the revelation that we have this gigantic fleet of Obsidian Order and Tal Shiar ships decloaking to go enter the wormhole. 20 ships, Cam. Compared to the fleets that we get later on in Deep Space Nine, it shocked me when they described this early on.
Yeah.
In part one, like, we've been building a fleet for months, and it's 20 ships. So it's just like, huh. So it's like 10 Romulan warbirds, 10 Cardassian Galer class vessels, I guess.
Question.
Yes.
At the time of this episode's airing, for the franchise, was this the largest fleet we'd ever seen?
From my recollection,
at least in television.
Yeah, like I think even at that point in the movies too.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you could have said, well, maybe Wolf 359, we did see it depicted in Emissary part 1.
Mm-hmm.
So, It was up there. I remember watching it at the time being like, wow. Like,
right.
It was impressive. Nothing could hold a candle to it until very shortly later we do get to Way of the Warrior. That blew me away too. But
right. This
is kind of having 20 years to look back at it, I'm just like, that ain't so big. And then Starfleet's following up with a giant fleet of 9 ships to help protect Bajor.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that, you know, if that was the ending of a call to arms, you know, the Defiant joins a fleet of 9 ships, I don't think I would have been nearly as excited for season 6 to begin as I was there.
Right. And this was a real episode of firsts. This was the first credit for Ira Stephen Bear as exec producer. And this was also the very first time we got to see an admiral in the 24th century wearing gold.
Yeah, how was your reaction? Let's talk about Admiral Todman for a little while, because you and I kind of balked at this character.
How did we miss this character for our, what was it called? The Starfleet Admirals Who Suck?
Why do Starfleet Admirals suck?
Episode, yeah, we did a while back.
I mean, hey, let's start with the name Todman.
It's not dynamic when you've got Sisko, Dax, Odo, Kira, Todman.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're almost trying to get you to dislike this character.
Oh, I think it's true because the fact of the matter is he's designed to go up against Sisko.
Yeah.
That's another character we need to discuss in a moment or two. But essentially he's saying, like, let's go ahead and let this combined fleet destroy an entire species and make this empire on the other side of the galaxy crumble. Meh. You know, why not? You know, this really seems like an anti-Federation sort of stance. Do you think this is maybe one of the reasons why they put him in a gold uniform?
I don't know. Or was it just different?
Why do the gold uniform, though?
I don't know. Did we ever see an admiral in, like, the science colors?
Nope. Not that I ever recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe at, like, a, you know, like a lecture or something? You know, one of those episodes where Picard has to go to, like, some sort of gathering? No.
No, I think this is the only off-color sort of admiral seat.
Because Todman is off-color.
Yeah. I think the only other time we might see a gold admiral's uniform would be in Homefront in Paradise Lost, which would be coming up in season 4.
Right.
Sisko's return to Earth, and he's not shucking clams there, thankfully. But I don't know. Yeah, interesting kind of thing. Anyways, this Todman character, pretty lame, though.
Well, he is lame in that he's not really even a character. But what I liked about Todman is that he really does hammer home that sort of ambiguity that Deep Space Nine has, where he's saying, well, we don't really want this fleet attacking, you know, the Dominion, but if they succeed, it's not such a bad thing. But hey, Sisko, just be ready in case, you know, something bad happens.
But is that the Federation that we know from, say, Next Generation?
Definitely not.
Yeah, so that it took me back.
Nechayev is not sending these same orders.
Well, even like Nechayev, the episode Journey's End, which I'm not really going to defend that much, but Nechayev, when she was telling Picard, look, we're going to have to remove these Aboriginal people from the planet, even by force, like Nechayev was like, look, wasn't my call. I argued with Starfleet Command about that. We get a guy like Todman who's just like, yeah, let's just let them kill each other off. Why not? You know, I'm just like, huh. Meanwhile, we have Eddington observing all this. I'm wondering if we're starting to see seeds planted for Eddington and looking at the hypocrisy that is the Federation as we know it here.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how characters like Todman really poke holes in the concept of the Gene Roddenberry utopia.
Yes.
When you have a character saying this, they're not living utopia.
Well, look, we do have in the episode, I believe, is the Maquis, where Sisko says it's easy to be a saint when you're living in paradise. And he's referring to how easygoing it is on, say, Earth.
Which right, yes.
Doesn't have any issues. Todman is based on Earth, though. So, he ain't no saint, is he?
Is it more that it's only a utopia for kind of the commoners, you know, the people who are just living their day-to-day lives, whereas these muckety-muck higher-ups in Starfleet are, like, doing all these dirty dealings?
Okay, you know what? I'm going to pose this. I just came to my head. What if Todman is, in fact, a Section 31 operative or something? This seems more like the hands of Section 31.
Hold on, Tyler. I'm going to have to cut this episode short. I've got another fan fiction episode to write.
Todman, secret agent. Yeah. What you don't know is Todman's his first name.
Yeah. I thought it was like a single name, like Rihanna.
No, it was like, it's actually first name Todd, last name Man.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Nice, nice.
So, yes, Todd Man, secret agent. No, this seems more like Section 31 business. We also have the Tal Shiar Obsidian Order involved here, so maybe I could retrofit this into my brain, justify that maybe Starfleet/the Federation's not so bad. It's just a bad actor like Todman being influenced by a very shady organization like Section 31.
But how many douches like Todman are there operating at high levels of Starfleet?
Well, what we discovered in our episode, Why Do Starfleet Admirals Suck, is that it's filled with nothing but just feckless sorts. Like the worst of the worst. Like, get them off those starship bridges, out of the captain seats. Let's promote them and make them the worst people ever. Because, Cam, you, I believe you're the one that pointed out, they're designed essentially to make the captains look correct
right.
at all times. Can we segue into Sisko, though?
Yeah, let's do so.
You've got one officer who's stranded on the other side of the galaxy. Do you risk a court-martial and risk the lives of a whole lot of other crew members, you know, mm-hmm. just to go rescue this one? Does it, is Sisko justified in what he's doing?
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, Tyler.
So, no?
Yeah, I'd say no.
Yeah, I don't understand why Sisko's doing this. Like, I mean, to give him something to do in the episode, yes.
For sure, yeah. No, I had the same thought. And also, you know, when Sisko gives the whole pitch, like, okay, everyone, you're all going to risk court-martials for this, but I'll be at the Defiant at whatever time, he said. And I mean, I began to think in my head, in a real-world scenario, I'd be curious how many would show up for this mission.
Well, also, how many people, how do people find out about this mission? He just tells, like, the senior staff members.
Yeah.
And plus O'Brien. And so do they have to go around to, like, their subordinates and say, hey, if you want to go on a mission and get rid of your career in Starfleet, come join us.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all well and good for, you know, the people like Sisko and Dax or whatever. But what about, you know, the working class sort of Starfleet members like O'Brien represents?
Yeah. Like
what does he gain from this?
They're all friends with Odo. They care about him. And they'd hope that he would do the same thing for them. But
sure.
What about the guy whose job is to, I don't know, collect all the self-sealing stem bolts like right. in main engineering? Like, why would he go on this mission and risk his career?
At least when Kirk had the audacity to pull, you know, go against Starfleet orders and go find Spock, he had a skeleton crew.
Yeah.
It was just like the, you know, the main cast.
I would have liked if they depicted some sort of skeleton crew here. But this seemed like a fully staffed USS Defiant at this point. So I think the other thing that's a little curious is that you have all the senior staff mm-hmm. going along with this. And
no one argued.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been a great scene to have a dialogue like, why should we not do this?
I can give you a whole list. I just gave you a whole list of reasons why you shouldn't.
Yeah.
It's one officer.
Like, why not even have Eddington speak up in that meeting and be like, listen, we should not be doing this because of blank, blank, and blank.
He's a Todman shill, man.
I know.
Yeah.
It is strange. It just seems like a really great moment to have, you know, some dramatic conversation.
Be like, hey, Ben, I appreciate what you're doing, but I would have liked it if not the entire senior staff agreed to go on this mission.
Yeah, and make an argument as to why Odo does need to be retrieved.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's tough. But, okay, so the entire senior staff get on this. Who's in charge of Deep Space Nine? Who's running the station at this point?
Jake.
Is he? Okay.
Yeah.
Nog's getting prepared for his Starfleet Academy entrance exam, so they give him ops.
I guess so. Yeah, okay. That's an excellent question because there's no one left. I mean,
I assumed, you know, Eddington was not going to go on this mission.
Right.
He would have been left behind to take charge of the station. But no,
that's
there.
That's what he wanted.
Well, he's there as a saboteur.
Yeah.
So I don't know, a little bit of silliness there.
What did you think of the Eddington heel turn, that Eddington is the one that sabotages the Defiant?
Well, they're telegraphing it pretty hard. So
right.
I totally buy it there. Yeah, I wonder if maybe one of these days we could tackle the arc of one Eddington and whether the writers just kind of made it up on the spot that he would eventually turn to the Maquis.
Right.
Or if, in fact, I don't know. I still think they made it up on the spot that he went to the Maquis. But it's interesting to see how there's different seeds planted because he's presented as such a company man throughout Deep Space Nine, up until the episode in which he's revealed as the Maquis traitor, essentially.
Right.
And, so I don't know. What do you think of Eddington and his heel turn here, Cam?
I liked it because it's the idea that, yes, he'll sabotage the ship, but the show doesn't necessarily give away that he's a complete heel. Like, he's not going to pull off what he does later down the road in the next season or whatever with For the Uniform and what have you. I really liked this moment because it's a great character moment. A character like Eddington would not normally get the screen time that he deserves to develop, especially with a cast as diverse and big as DS9.
Yeah.
You know, we talked an episode or two ago about, maybe that was our Facebook bonus episode, which you can get at our Facebook group,
yep.
About Jonas, the saboteur on Voyager. Maybe that would be an episode, a comparison between how Voyager handled that character versus Deep Space Nine.
The traitors of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Okay. I dig. So maybe can we talk a little bit about what Enbrin Tain is getting up to with the whole torture stuff. What do you make of Garak agreeing to interrogate Odo using this torture method? Do you buy it simply as him protecting Odo, or is there a part of him that wants to go back to this life? Because we see from the start, like, he wants to return to life on Cardassia. And you and I were talking about the parallels between Odo and Garak that weren't totally made clear until, I think, part two. But Odo, it's revealed in this interrogation scene, is craving to go back. Like, it's a revelation, I think as viewers as well, just seeing, oh, wow, here is this very, very mysterious kind of character, a very aloof sort of character like Odo. We see what's motivating him right now. He really, really desires to be part of his people once again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, him and Garak, they're both, you know, alienated from essentially the rest of the crew of the, you know, the show, the rest of the cast, all these characters. They both want to go home and can't because of, you know, whatever, their people are just involved in war. And it makes a fascinating parallel. But why do I think, what do I think of Garak torturing Odo? I got the sense that he does want Tain's approval. He does want to be back with him. And I think he takes on the Odo job because he does want to protect Odo. And I think he, at least maybe through his head, he's thinking Odo might be willing to kind of deal with him quicker and make it more painless than if you send in the Romulan.
He can find like a balance.
Yeah. 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 Like Odo's going to be quicker to maybe deal with him than, you know, faceless Romulan torture.
Wasn't a faceless Romulan torture. Let's say it's this Colonel Lovak character. Yeah.
What happens then?
Okay, well, let's talk about this twist, because I do recall complaining a lot about the big twist in The Search Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's revealed.
The one that, blew me away?
The one that blew you away. And I'll articulate why I did not care for that one, but I liked this Lovak reveal, where Lovak is revealed at the end to be a changeling. With The Search Part 2, it's suddenly out of nowhere, no hints given whatsoever that this is all, pretty much all of part two is taking place in the heads of half the main cast, essentially.
Right.
And it's the Dominion doing like this weird kind of computer simulation to see how they would react to aggressive Dominion presence, what have you. I really didn't like that twist because it was playing a trick on the audience. There were no hints at all, or no way for an audience member to figure out what was going on.
Right.
How could you possibly guess that particular twist, which I didn't care for? This, with Lovak, there were a lot of hints being planted early on where, you know, he's taking an interest in Odo. He seems, if there's anybody who's going to be a perfect kind of infiltrator here on the part of the Dominion, this would be the guy, you know. So this is why I actually do like this particular twist. What did you make of it, though, Cam?
I really liked it, too. And yeah, there are subtle hints. Of course, he's saying, you know, he wants to take Odo back with him at the end. You know, he's obviously wants to get Odo away from the, you know, the Cardassian, which, you know, is perfect. You know, it totally pays off in the end. And it's a character that isn't so prominent that it feels weird to have him change at the end, no pun intended. you know, he's prominent enough that he's a face that stands out. And so when he does have his twist at the end, we're like kind of surprised by it.
Yeah. And look, it brings up a very good point here where he says, no changeling has ever harmed another.
Right.
That's why I'm helping you get off the ship right now. Why couldn't they just transport him away? Lovak gets to transport safely, and then it looks like Garak and Odo are going to get obliterated by the Jem'Hadar in that runabout before the Defiant comes to the rescue.
He's kind of not that concerned about getting Odo safely off the ship.
Is he more the one who's like, I can't kill you, but I don't have to save you?
Batman Begins philosophy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. So with that, though...
Who's the Ra's al Ghul in this equation? Is it Odo?
It would be Odo. So
Garak has more of the ambiguity of Ra's al Ghul.
No, but the thing is, like, Lovak's not really trying to save Odo, just like Batman didn't really try to save Ra's al Ghul.
No,
so
you're dead right.
Colonel Lovak is Batman.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which means the
changeling... That part is flawless. I can't see any hole in, yes.
Well, think about it, because the changeling in his natural form would have to be Bruce Wayne. He takes the form of Colonel Lovak. And Ra's al Ghul, like Odo's version of being in his natural form, would essentially be Ken Watanabe.
Of course.
Am I blowing your mind right now?
It's all coming together.
Okay. So what,
Tyler,
what...
I may need to cut this podcast short. I think I have a third fan fiction story to be writing.
Okay. Who's Garak in the Batman Begins equation?
Okay. Scarecrow?
Scarecrow.
He does induce fear into people.
Oh, okay. Right? Yeah, that's true. Okay, Cam. We figured it out.
He has his weird little light-up device versus fear gas, you know?
Okay. Well,
and he does then recur throughout the series in a supporting role.
That, yeah. You
is Garak the Scarecrow of Deep Space Nine?
He is a regular Jonathan Crane.
Yeah.
I dig it. Okay, Cam. We figured it out. It's been 20 years in the making. We had to get Warner Brothers to fund a giant blockbuster film, but we've cracked the code for Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
There you go.
And its links to comic books.
Right. A movie that was produced how many years later? Like over a decade later?
Yes. Okay, so who's Rachel Dawes?
Tane?
Sure. Let's go with that. Pretty much the same figures.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so Cam, I have to ask this though. If you are a spy, you know, you sign up to be the Tal Shiar, it's the coolest club around when it comes to being an intelligence operative. How choked would you be if your duty is to take the fire extinguisher and put out fires on a starship like
it's
we saw?
It's pretty lame. Yeah. It's pretty lame.
It's like essentially being like, yeah, I work for the CIA. I mop the floors there.
How would you rank the three kind of groups in order of coolness? Section 31, Tal Shiar, or Obsidian Order?
Coolness. Okay.
Like, who's the one that you sound the most badass belonging to?
I think it's Obsidian Order, personally.
Yeah, that's the one that I would rank first.
Yeah. Okay, what would follow, though? The thing is, we know so little about Section 31. We know Luther Sloan, and he's got those tight spandex uniforms.
Right.
And
they will let, like, Reed in. And
so yeah, like, I know. That kind of...
That kind of lowers them.
Yeah.
Now, were the Tal Shiar at all involved in any way with the embedded Romulans on Vulcan? If they were, they're at the bottom.
I'm glad you brought up the embedded Romulans, because I was going to ask you what exactly was the ultimate plan of the fleet. You know, did they actually, instead of destroying the mantle of this planet in the Omarian Nebula, why not just get embedded with those changelings there?
Yeah, it's an excellent question.
Yeah, okay. How many soldiers, again, were going to be embedded on Vulcan in Unification?
I think it was 1,000, wasn't it?
I think it was like 5,000.
5,000? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll take over an entire planet.
Right.
Filled with billions of people. But Cam, they were embedded.
That's true.
I don't
That's
believe true. The Tal Shiar were involved with that plot.
Okay. I might give them second place then.
Over Section 31?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. I think they've got more... Look, nobody knows about Section 31, really.
Right.
So I think they're... again, if you're in the Star Trek universe and you walked up to people and be like, I'm in Section 31... You just get blank stares.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. When I think of some of the membership of Section 31, they're not like the coolest cats around.
No. Yeah, you've got what? Admiral Ross?
Done.
Yeah.
Last place right there.
You've got Malcolm Reed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got O'Brien. I like O'Brien, but I mean...
Well, O'Brien's not a member of Section 31.
He's not
31.
A member, but he... Or sorry, I'm Bashir.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's a potential recruit.
No, I'm thinking of the episode. Didn't O'Brien do a little bit of work for them?
No, he... Remember... No, it was the episode Extreme Measures where Luther Sloan essentially tries to commit suicide. So they go into O'Brien and Bashir go into his brain and they walk through corridors of the Defiant.
That's what I'm thinking about.
I'm thinking if it's like the third, or no, I think this is one of the last episodes before we kicked off kind of the end of the series. I think it was kind of, I don't know, it wasn't the best use of your third to last episode, I do say.
Right, right.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think we can agree that it goes Obsidian Order, Tal Shiar, and Section 31 in descending order of coolness.
Okay. Cam, one last thing that I should say to the listeners. You and I, we were watching this episode. We are presented with this device that has the ability to keep Odo in his form that he has right now.
Yeah.
You know, that humanoid form.
Great makeup, by the way.
I thought it was fantastic. And
way to go, Michael Westmore.
Yeah.
Once again.
I'm also wondering about how much the makeup department had to work with the costume department on that as well. Mm-hmm. But how it goes, though, essentially, is that Odo, I love Odo's reaction. He's very sarcastic, like, oh, are you here to torture me? I'm so scared, Garrick. Like, big deal. But, Cam, a few weeks ago, we tackled the topic of who is the ultimate Star Trek fighter.
Yes.
And we were kind of reluctant to let Odo go too far. Otherwise, we just kept coming up with ideas where he would just turn his arms into scissors and just chop everyone's heads off.
Right.
And we were like, well, this can't really... Really? And I think... Ultimately, the argument that we made, though, is that we agreed at the beginning this is hand-to-hand combat, mm-hmm. and we haven't seen evidence of Odo being all that great at hand-to-hand combat. So there we do get a point made by Garrick saying, like, oh, yeah, you can just turn yourself into a razorback or else take your hands and stretch across the room and strangle me right now. But I've got this machine that's going to stop you from doing that. So I do want to touch upon that point. He kind of articulated some of the arguments that I think other people would make about why Odo would kick everyone's butt in the ultimate Star Trek fighter challenge. But I still feel confident that we're okay with not making Odo go to the next bracket.
I would just like to say I voted for Odo in that round.
You did, but Cam, it was hand-to-hand combat.
It's true. So, it's true.
There you go.
It's tough. Odo is sort of like, you know, the Sandman or even Hydro Man in Spider-Man comics, where if you really think about it, they're pretty much unbeatable.
Yeah.
Unless you know, they have like their one weakness, but other than that, good luck.
To me, it's just no fun when you have like this unbeatable character.
Yes.
So I'm just like,
okay. I think there's a reason that Deep Space Nine rarely, well, also budget, but rarely went over the top with Odo's abilities at all. They had him turning into like tops and things like that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they never just had him like as some sort of like war machine with like blades coming out of his hands or whatever. He was never like the T-1000. I think had they done that, it would have taken a lot of the drama away from an episode like this, where you have him being tortured and... You know, if he wanted to, you know, judging from what Garrick is telling us, essentially, Odo could get out of there if he wanted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Cam, any final thoughts on this two-parter, Improbable Cause and the Dies Cast?
Well, let's talk about, does this work as a two-parter?
Yes.
Because that's obviously a conversation we have with, you know, all of our two-parters. And this is a kind of a curious one because, again, they have two different titles, almost implying they are kind of separate stories in a way.
I think what you and I thought of when we first decided that we're going to review two-part episodes following our reviews of all the films is that as long as it says... to be continued.
Yeah.
And they are just a 1-2 punch. We couldn't include episodes like that three-part episode that kicked off season 2 of Deep Space Nine or some of those 3 or 4-part Enterprise season 4 episodes. This, I think we can safely call it a 2-part episode here.
I think so too. I mean, on BBC, it was actually aired as a 2-hour episode. They actually
edited it
together. Yeah.
Okay.
I would like to actually watch it in that format.
Yeah. I wonder if the editing was that much different or if essentially they just took away the to be continued.
Probably.
Yeah. Okay.
But that means it is essentially one story. We don't have to make the argument so much that it is a two-parter.
Well, okay, and that's just it. You and I, we often say, well, does this story justify itself as being worth a two-part episode? I don't think you and I really need to, well, I don't know, maybe you would disagree, but I say totally yes. There's enough character stuff going on between Odo and Garrick. I think it's a fascinating idea of this preemptive strike against the Dominion and how it fails. I love the kind of spy thriller intrigue going on throughout it. To me, it totally justifies itself as a two-part episode.
Yeah, it really does trace this relationship between Odo and Garrick throughout, from beginning, you know, right until its ending. And also, it's a great look at Garrick that is invaluable to the character and how we look at him going forward. I think as a single story in that regard. Yes, it does commit a sin that I held against TNG a lot, where I would say this, you know, two-parter really shuns most of the characters.
Right, right.
But in this regard, because DS9's a little different and it is more about tackling mythology, it does work. I can't argue against how brilliantly it does explore the character of Garak and, you know, his relationship with Odo.
As we go deeper into these Deep Space Nine two-parters, I mean, I would put the we've watched four at this point, Emissary, The Maquis, The Search, Past Tense, and now this two-parter.
Yeah.
I would put this at the top.
Yes.
But as we go deeper into the repertoire of Deep Space Nine two-parters.
Ooh la la.
Yeah. I think this, just with the way my memory is going, this might be more of a middling sort of two-parter, though. Like,
I don't know. I'll be very curious because, again, like I said earlier, going forward at this point in Deep Space Nine, my memory of episode titles and that stuff is so blurry that I'm going to be really curious to see if they get, you know, because this episode, I think, is has a lot of impact to it.
Yeah, see, this is why I you and I have chatted about it before. I don't like binge-watching. I like the week-to-week digestion that you get from just thinking about an episode for a long period of time. And
that's why you've been watching Iron Fist one episode at a week, right?
I kid you not, my girlfriend's actually watching this.
Did she? Is she? Okay.
She says it's excruciating. I'm just like, really? Well, why are you watching it? She's just like, well, just so that there's sound on in the apartments.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's like, okay. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm not a fan of binging, though.
Right.
And I like that with regards to Star Trek Discovery, even though it's going to be on a streaming service like CBS All Access and Netflix through most of the world, I do like how it's dropping just once a week as opposed to all at once. I really think that's how Star Trek should be viewed. And because you're encountering kind of that problem that I don't want to have, where a lot of the episodes just kind of blur together, so it's hard to delineate.
Well, also, Star Trek specifically, you know, episodes are a lot of the time about tackling a moral or a message or a philosophical idea. Having that week separation allows, you know, the viewer to sit and think about the meanings of the episode.
Yeah.
Whereas when you watch four, you know, five episodes at a time, yes, you're going to get the story. You know, it's going to be moving quicker because you're burning through the arc. But the individual messages to each episode are kind of lost.
Right.
And that's very much the case with Deep Space Nine, because even though there is the Dominion War arc and all that sort of stuff, individual episodes have individual themes.
Yeah, and that's why I'm such a big fan of the Dominion War arc that kicked off season six, because each one of those episodes are so distinct from each other, you know?
Right.
So it's going to be good when we get the chance to tackle those sooner than people might think.
Yes, very much so.
All right, sir.
Well, I had a little bit of trivia I'll just throw end here.
I always do horribly, but go for it.
Now, Ron Moore said of Improbable Cause, this was one of his favorites.
Okay.
And he said the other being House of Quark.
Interesting. Favorites of all time, or of like season three, or was House of Quark season three?
He just said one of my favorites.
Ah.
So that is left to interpretation to a certain degree.
Hey, look, you've got the introduction of Enerbrin Tain, some cool spy mythology. I can't, you know, disregard his opinion.
Right.
So there you go.
And the other trivia was, you remember when we talked about unification, how they were shot out of order?
Yes.
Right, with the second being shot first. Similar sort of scenario in this regard, where the die is cast was not shot after Improbable Cause. They'd already started production on Through the Looking Glass. So that was shot after Improbable Cause, and then they shot the die is cast after.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, because, I mean, when we talk about these two episodes, Improbable Cause and the die is cast, the flow feels very consistent. How many TNG two-parters did we talk about where it felt like two different episodes just grafted together?
I know. Sometimes they feel really all over the place. So, yeah, I don't know. I do like the consistency that we get here, though.
Yeah, it's very consistent two-parter. Like, the overall just feel of it feels very unified. Like, it doesn't feel like, you know, Birthright.
Oh, gosh.
Or even Unification, for that matter.
Yeah, I know. Oh, dear.
Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Or you can also go to our Facebook page, Tyler.
Yeah,
give them the spiel.
That's at facebook.com/subspacepod. We just posted our first Facebook exclusive episode. We don't want to like spoil the surprise, but essentially, Cam, I think it's safe to announce that we're now doing episode commentaries. These are not things that you can download from, say, your podcast feed or anything like that. You're going to go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. And you'll be able to access our exclusive commentary episodes from there. Just like our page, follow us, share it with your friends. The more you share, the more of these we'll do. And
the more we'll care.
And the more we'll care, yeah. No, look, this is a fun episode that we chose, and we're going to be choosing other fun episodes in the future. So keep at it. Please like us on Facebook. Look, it's a free podcast. All we're asking is you guys give us maybe... 5 stars, leave us a review on iTunes, and like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter if you've got access to Twitter as well.
That's right. So, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Next week, we are tackling the best, worst episodes. This is the second time we've done it. So, Cam, give an example. What's an episode that we tackled in part one of best, worst episodes?
We talked about Bound, I recall, the Enterprise Orion episode. And we also talked about Sub Rosa. Those are two examples. Now, this one's a little different in that... around that time, we posted links, and other people started chiming in with their own suggestions. And so we've kind of taken some of those, added a few more of ours. And so it's going to be kind of a hodgepodge of best, worst episodes. It's going to be a lot of fun, and a lot that maybe didn't jump to my mind when we assembled our first episode.
Yeah, essentially the idea here is like episodes that are so bad, they're good, or at least fun to watch.
That's right.
Entertaining, nonetheless.
It's going to be a lot of fun doing research, I think.
Yes.
So looking forward to that. Okay, you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Very Big Fleet Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T, T is in Todman, O-N.
It's the new con scream.
Todman!
I better go write that fan fiction right now. Yes. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.